how this will be. Right, good afternoon. I put the recording I made on Monday on the web pages. Have a look whether it is useful for you or not. It seemed to be that when I'm walking around, the sound wasn't picked up well, so I'll try today with a microphone to see whether this comes out better. Right. We have homework due today. Please make sure I'm not leaving the room without your homework. Are there any questions about the homework you're just handing in or about... Yeah. Sure. actually, no, you asked, would you mind? I don't mind. So,
so would you?
Yeah, I will do this. I will do this. Okay. So we have, as we take the integers and we say that A shall be equivalent to B by definition, if and only if the difference a minus b is in the integers. Okay. So, did I say no? I mean, the integers is not that interesting, right? I should take the real numbers. Yeah. I mean, I can also do it for the integers, but then basically anything is equivalent. It's an equivalence relation, but not a very interesting one. Okay. So I take the real numbers. So what I need to show is I need to show reflexivity. Well, if A is a real number, then A minus A absolute value is the absolute value of 0, which is 0, and that is clearly in the integers. All right? Oh, yeah, and since I say the integers, I wouldn't even need the absolute value here. I could have set the natural numbers including 0, but that's fine. So that means A is equivalent to itself. Okay, symmetry. Suppose A is equivalent to B. What does this mean? This means that the absolute value of A minus B is in the integers. But the absolute value of A minus B is the same as the absolute value of B minus A. And therefore, we can conclude that also B is equivalent to A. So it is symmetric. The only thing which is slightly interesting is transitivity. So now I suppose A is equivalent to B, and B is equivalent to C. Okay, what does this mean by definition? This means that the absolute, that, let's say I set X is equal to A minus B, Y is equal to B minus C, and I have that the absolute value of X is in the integers. And of course, that means also that X is in the integers and that Y is in the integers, right? And now I want to look, is A equivalent to C, right? So what I need to do is I need to consider the absolute value of A minus C. Well, since I have A minus B and B minus C, I insert a minus plus B. This is the same as A minus B plus B minus C. This was X, this was Y, so it's the absolute value of X plus Y. And because X and Y are in the integers, this is in the integers, so clearly this is an integer. So we can conclude that A is equivalent to C in this case, and we've shown the transitivity. Well, so indeed it is an equivalence relation. What are we doing there? Basically, you can imagine this, that we take the real numbers, consider them as a long strip and we roll it up, we have a small wheel which has circumference exactly one, and we just roll it up, right? Two numbers are equivalent if their difference is an integer. So I start rolling up, I have 1/2 here, I go back to 1 here. If I roll up further, 1.5 again ends up here, 2 ends up here, and so forth. And I just care where does the number end up on the circle. That's one way how one could imagine the equivalence classes are basically just the points on this circle. So that's this equivalence relation. The last part asked, does it hold also for the complex numbers? Well, there is one place where I'm actually using that I have the real numbers, namely this place here, where I say if the absolute value of a real number is an integer, the real number itself is an integer. And that does not hold over the complex numbers, right? If you take, for example, I, the root of -1, this has absolute value 1, but it clearly is not an integer. So that's where things break down. Then you can't do this argument anymore. And indeed, what you can easily have in the complex numbers, you can just pick, if you have a point here, equivalent, if this was a relation, equivalent would be everything at radius, say at radius 1. So I can choose a point here. Again, I go from here by radius 1, so, or integer radii in general, so I get something here, and now suddenly this is not an integer distance between these two points, because I can basically choose the angle whatever I want, and I can get horrible irrational things there. Right? So therefore, this doesn't work anymore. That's a concrete example of why this wouldn't work anymore over the complex numbers. Basically, the proof would break down here. Okay? Other questions?
In that, you're saying you're substituting the complex number for the set of real numbers.
Yes, yes, if I would instead take the complex numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, then let's go back where we were. We defined last time the quotient ring of a ring by an ideal. Right? So we have, if R is a ring, we have A is an ideal. In R, the quotient ring is, we write as R modulo A. And what does it consist of? It consists of the cosets of A and R. So the elements of this quotient ring are the cosets A plus R, where R runs through the ring. And our arithmetic is based on the representative. So we have that A plus R plus A plus S is defined to be A plus R plus S, and the product, similarly, A plus R times A plus S is defined to be A plus R times S. And we've seen last time that it does not depend on the choice of representatives. Regardless what representative we choose, things are fine. We will get the same coset. We will get different representatives, but the same coset. And then we have seen that from this it follows almost automatically that this structure is a ring. Okay. Yeah. So let's look at some examples. We had already the integers, an example, the integers modulo, the ideal generated by a number. Let's say my ring are the rational polynomials, and let's suppose my ideal A is the ideal generated by x squared plus x plus 1. Okay. Then, how can I describe the cosets of A? Well, because every coset has the form A plus R for some polynomial R, and I can change that polynomial by a multiple of x squared plus x plus 1 without changing the coset, I can find in each coset a polynomial of degree smaller than 2 as a representative, right? So each coset contains, and it contains actually only one, exactly one polynomial of degree strictly smaller than 2. So my cosets are of the form a plus, okay, and now a polynomial of degree strictly smaller than 2, so I can say ax plus b. Right. How do I do arithmetic with these cosets? Just copying basically the definition here. If I take a plus ax plus b, and I add to it the coset a plus cx plus d, by the definition we get that this is a plus, okay, now I add the representative, so I get a plus c times x plus b plus d. That's the sum of the cosets in that quotient ring. Similarly, for the product, if I take a plus ax plus b, and I multiply with a plus cx plus d, what do I get there? Well, now I have to multiply the representatives by definition. So I get, okay, multiplying this out, I get acx square plus, okay, now the x terms is ad plus bc times x plus bd. Okay, that's the product by definition. However, I said I wanted to describe the cosets with representatives of this form. So how can I bring this representative? How can I get rid of the x squared term? Well, let's just note that a plus x squared is the same as a minus x minus 1. Why is this the case? Because x squared, well, just the criterion for equality of cosets, because x squared minus minus x minus 1 lies in the ideal. So I can replace the ac x squared term by ac times minus x minus 1. So this product of the cosets here, I could also write as a plus, okay, now I get ad plus bc minus ac times x plus bd minus ac. That's the product of these two cosets. And if you look at the representatives, what I have done is just arithmetic with polynomials, with possible remainders, and done arithmetic modulo the polynomial x squared plus x plus 1. It's nothing else than what we've done before in homework exercises when we looked at modulo arithmetic for polynomials. The only thing which is different now we have a proper formal setting for this, namely the setting of a quotient ring. And because of this, we know that what we get there as a result is automatically guaranteed to be a ring. We don't need to, wouldn't need to go through testing the properties. We are guaranteed that it is a ring. Actually, if you look at what is the role of X here, well, X basically will be an element that if you square it and add it to itself and add 1 to it, you get 0. So I can consider the ring, this quotient ring also. So note R modulo A is isomorphic fig to the ring Q. Okay. Now just to write things easier, I make one choice. I say let, well, some element, some letter which I'm not using otherwise, let's say little z, let this be a root of x square plus x plus 1. You could calculate it with a quadratic equation. So we could take the ring qz, which are elements of the form az plus b, where a and b are rational numbers. And what I want you to think about here is the example we had, q square root of 5. We had this in some homework example as a ring. All elements of the form a square root of 5 plus b, or we had it as a plus b square root of 5. Obviously, it doesn't matter how I call the letters. Such a ring. So that ring, actually, I claim is isomorphic to this quotient ring, namely, under the map. Okay, I map the coset a plus ax plus b. I map this coset simply to az plus b. And now, because z is the root of the polynomial which generates a, this makes this a homomorphism which behaves okay also with multiplication. And then it's not hard to see that it's onto and one to one, because it's pretty clear how I map, how I get every element, and that two different elements will be mapped to different images. So this kind of ring we can also in some way interpret as a quotient ring, and therefore, again, one wouldn't really need, once we know this, we wouldn't really need to prove that it is a ring. We get it automatically from the general theorem that a quotient ring is always a ring. Okay. Let's look at one other example. Let's say my ring are the 2x2 matrices over the rational numbers. And let's say my ideal shall be those matrices where, wait, do I want to do this? Sorry, no, sorry, this is not actually what I want to do. Let me do just, then the argument is easy. Let's say in matrices with integer entries, and let's say I take as ideal the 2x2 matrices where my entries are even integers. This is an ideal basically because if you have a matrix where the entries, where if you have two matrices where the entries are even integers, you can add them up and the result again are even integers. If you have a matrix where the entries are even integers and you multiply it with an arbitrary matrix, because you could take the factor 2 out in the product, also the entries will be all even integers. So that's why this is an ideal. Now again, we can form the quotient ring, and here the quotient ring actually is a somewhat more complicated object, right? So my quotient ring consists, well, what is this thing? My quotient ring, certainly I know, consists of cosets of the form A plus R, where R lies in the ring. That always holds. So there are cosets of this ideal with matrices as representatives. Okay, can I describe the representatives here? Can I describe them in some way? Well, if I take a matrix whose entries are integers, I know I can subtract a matrix whose entries are even integers and make every entry in the matrix either 0 or 1, right? If I have the matrix 4, 3, 1, 2, I can if I have the matrix 4, 3, 1, 2, I claim this is the same as coset, this is the same as the coset with the representative. Okay, now I subtract the matrix 4, 2, 0, 2. This has all even entries, and I make it to 0, 1, 1, 0. Right? So I can make every entry of the matrix, of a matrix 1 or 0, by subtracting a matrix where all the entries are even. So I know that the cosets in R modulo A, actually, I can now describe by all the matrices where the entries are just 0 or 1. So I can take A plus the 0 matrix, I can take A plus the matrix 1, 0, 0, 0, I can take A plus the matrix 0, 1, 0, 0, A plus the matrix 0, 0, 1, 0, A plus the matrix 0, 0, 0, 1, A plus 1, 1, 0, 0, and so forth. There are 16 such elements in total. Right? And if you now look at these representatives, in particular, once you see how they are added and multiplied, you will see this would basically be the matrices with entries modulo chosen from the integers modulo 2. So these would be 2 by 2 matrices over the field with 2 elements. That ring would be isomorphic to this one. So that's one way how one can interpret this quotient ring here. But in general, there isn't necessarily an obvious way how one can interpret the quotient ring. And again, that's basically the reason why we do quotient rings, because we want to use it to construct new rings with particular properties. Okay, so let's now start looking at properties of the quotient rings, unless there are questions about any of these examples. Yeah?
When you started writing down that this previous example here, you said R modulo A for the top of the term. Did you mean to say that? Or
here?
The very top of the board, you said R modulo A. Is that the same?
Sometimes people call it R modulo A instead of the quotient ring of R by A. Okay. And the reason is basically because it is a generalization of the modulo arithmetic, yes. And it's easier to say, it's shorter to write down R modulo A than to say the quotient ring of R by the ideal A.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question. This is kind of a weird question, but when you wrote down your R over A, there should be 16 elements
In
this coset.
Not in the coset, there should be 16 elements in the quotient ring, right? Oh. So there are 16 cosets in the quotient ring.
Isn't
yeah.
One, the matrix like 1, 1, 0, yeah. 0,
yeah.
Repeated, because I mean you have the ones here and then you swap them. That would be a different element, I guess.
You mean the matrix 0, 0, 1, 1 or something?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, that's one of the remaining elements, yeah. I mean, so far I've written 6 down and there are 10 missing.
Yeah, I was like writing them down and I couldn't get all 16 because I feel like, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, you get 0, 0, 1, 1, you get 0, 1, 0, 1, you get 1, 0, 1, 0. Okay, and then you get 3 ones and you have 4 of them and you get the one which has all ones.
Okay.
So let's look at properties of the quotient ring. And what I want to do is, in the end, I want to see how certain properties of the ideal will give me properties of the quotient ring. But first, let's make two easy observations. If R is a ring with 1, let's suppose A is an ideal in R, then R modulo A is a ring with 1. And similarly, if R is commutative, A is an ideal in R, then R modulo A is commutative. Okay, why is this the case? So in the first part, I just need to give you what is the one element of R modulo A. And again, in part for lack of better ideas, let's just try A plus 1. I claim A plus 1 is the one element of the quotient ring R modulo A. Why is this the case? Because if I take A plus R and I multiply with A plus 1, this is A plus R times 1, and R times 1 is R, so this is A plus R, and the other way around, other product, other order is similar. Then we end up with 1 times R. So A plus 1 is a one element of R modulo A. And the second part, why is R modulo A commutative? Well, if I take A plus R and I multiply with A plus S, this is equal to, by definition, how I do arithmetic in the quotient ring, A plus R times S, because the ring is commutative, this is A plus S times R, and that is A plus S times A plus R. So if my ring is commutative, the quotient ring is commutative. So ring with 1 and quotient ring get inherited, commutative ring get inherited by the quotient ring. Other properties don't necessarily get inherited. Does integral domain get inherited? If I have an integral domain, is the quotient ring an integral domain? If you have an integral domain and you have an ideal in the integral domain, is the quotient ring, again, an integral domain?
It can't be.
Well, in some cases, it can be. For example, you could take the ideal which just consists of 0, and then the ring is isomorphic to the quotient ring. Yes, but it can go wrong. Indeed, it can go wrong. And an example of this you've seen already, namely in the case of the integers. Right? So let's just observe this. The integers are an integral domain, but if I take the integers modulo, let's say, now I just choose a number which is not prime, let's say 6 times the integers, and we had seen this is isomorphic to the integers modulo 6. This is not. This is not an integral domain, right? We have zero divisors here in the integers modulo 6. Namely, what are zero divisors? A plus 2 times A plus 3 is equal to A plus 0. Because 2 times 3 is 6. Because 2 times 3 is in the ideal. Right? Yeah, A, I should say, what is A? In this case, A is just 6 times the integers. So when I have an integral domain, this doesn't necessarily get inherited by a quotient ring. I can start with an integral domain, and the quotient ring is not an integral domain. Okay, since I want to use the construction of quotient rings to construct rings with bespoke properties, what I now want to do is I want to investigate the question, how can I make my quotient ring an integral domain? Okay, what is going wrong here? Why is the quotient ring not an integral domain? It is because I have these two elements, 2 and 3 of my ring, which neither of them lies in the ideal, right? They're not multiples of 6, but their product lies in the ideal. And therefore, the product of the corresponding cosets gives me 0, while neither of them is 0, right? That's why the quotient ring is not an integral domain. And this concept, we will see in a moment, actually is exactly the reason why the quotient ring is not an integral domain. So this motivates the following definition. Let's say R is a ring. Let's assume it is commutative, though we don't really need it. It just makes our life easier if we talk about commutative rings, because integral domains, we always want to be commutative. So let's say we have a commutative ring, and let's say we have an ideal in R. The ideal A is called a prime ideal and if you want, think of it in of the term like in prime rib or so, denoting something particularly nice. These are particularly nice ideals. The ideal A is called a prime ideal if, okay, and now I basically want to avoid something like this happening. So what I want, if for all elements, let's call them R and S in the ring, we have that if R times S is in the ideal, this means that R is in the ideal or S is in the ideal. Okay. This is different than the property of ideal. Property of ideal set, if I take an element in the ideal and I multiply with an arbitrary ring element, I stay in the ideal. This is a different property. This is in some way the converse. This is saying if I take two arbitrary ring elements and I ask and I look at the case that these two arbitrary ring elements have a product which lies in the ideal, then actually one of the factors has to lie already in the ideal. That can't happen otherwise. So, for example, well, I can just copy basically the example before. Let's say if I take as ring the integers, if I take as ideal the multiples of 6, this is not a prime ideal. Because 2 and 3 both are not elements of the ideal, but 2 times 3, which is equal to 6, is an element of the ideal. So that violates the property. I have two elements which are not in there, but their product is. So that is not a prime ideal. Let me also give you an example of a prime ideal. Let's say I pick the multiples of 7. I claim this is a prime ideal. And why is it a prime ideal? Well, let's assume that R times S lies in A. If R times S is in A, this means that R times S is a multiple of 7, is 7 times some element Z for Z some integer, right? But if R times S is a multiple of 7, now you use unique factorization in the integers. You know that if you have a factor 7 on the right side, you must have a factor 7 on the left side. Well, so this means that 7 must divide R, or 7 must divide S. And if 7 divides R, this means that R is in the ideal. If 7 divides S, that would mean that S is in the ideal. So prime ideals somehow also play a little bit, well, here actually in the integers, they are exactly the ideals generated by prime numbers. They somehow correspond to the situation that we have, that one has prime numbers. Okay. Let me also give you an example of an ideal where it is not that obvious that an ideal is a prime ideal, where we can't really talk anymore about prime numbers. So if we take as a ring the polynomials in the variables x and y, and let's say the ideal A is the ideal generated by x and y. So what was this? I'll get to you in a second. These were the polynomials which have, where every term in the polynomial has a factor x or a factor y. Or these were the polynomials which do not have any constant term. Okay, you still.
With your statement here,
yeah?
It's an OR statement, so if both R and S were in the...
That's fine. The OR in mathematics is always inclusive.
Okay.
It's not if you want to have an exclusive OR, like in the sense of the exam will be on the 10th or the 11th. They presumably assume that you don't have an exam on the 10th and the 11th. You would need to phrase it differently. You would have to say on the 10th or the 11th and not on the 10th and on the 11th.
Okay.
No, the OR is always, in mathematics, is always inclusive there. Okay, so I take the polynomials which have constant term 0, and we have seen before that this is an ideal. Okay, I claim this is a prime ideal. Okay, why is it a prime ideal? Well, actually, the easy way of proving it will be to look at the quotient ring. So let's say the proof is later, because I want to prove a theorem, which then will make it easy to see that this is prime ideal. Essentially, I mean, a reason for it, if you wanted to do a direct proof, you basically would have to argue, suppose you have two polynomials which are not in the ideal. If they're not in there, they both have a constant term, right? A non-zero constant term. And if you now multiply them, the constant term of the product is the product of the constant terms. So the product also has a non-zero constant term. So if neither factor is in the ideal, the product also is not in the ideal. And that's exactly the property, an equivalent formulation for the property here, right? I can either say if a product is in there, one of the factors has to be in there. Equivalently, I could say if both factors, this is just a contraposition, if neither factor is in the ideal, the product cannot be in the ideal. Okay, so, and here I can't really talk anymore about prime numbers or so. So clearly the concept of prime ideal is something more general. Okay, so the reason we defined this term prime ideal, this came really from the question here, is the quotient ring an integral domain? And that's what I want to prove now. Theorem, let's suppose R is a commutative ring. And the only reason why I want R to be commutative is basically because we said integral domains are commutative rings. That's really why we need this here, but otherwise it's just a red herring. Let's say R is a commutative ring, A is an ideal in R, then the quotient ring R modulo A is an integral domain. If and only if A is a prime ideal. Okay. And that result is already a first result of the type which I mentioned we would like to have. Gives a description. How can we get bespoke properties of the quotient ring from properties of the ideal? If I want to construct a new ring as a quotient ring, which I want to be an integral domain, for my ideal, I better pick a prime ideal. Because otherwise, the quotient ring is not an integral domain. Okay, let's prove this. So, it turns out it's easier to prove the negation. I prove equivalently that R modulo A is not an integral domain if and only if A is not a prime ideal. And why do I prove it that way? That just has to do with the definition of integral domain. Integral domain says there are no zero divisors. It's easier to argue to say I have zero divisors than to argue that I don't have some. That's the only reason why I negate it this way. Okay, so let's suppose that R modulo A has zero divisors. Let's suppose A plus little r is a zero divisor in R modulo A. What does this mean? This means, first, A plus r is non-zero, is not equal to the zero element in the quotient ring, which is A plus zero. Right? Second, another element, which is also non-zero, there exists an element A plus S, which is not equal to A plus zero, such that A plus R times A plus S is equal to A plus zero, right? I've just copied the definition of zero divisor. I have two elements. I have an element which is not zero, and I find another element which is not zero. That's just the definition of zero divisor. Okay, now I want to show that A is not a prime ideal. So I want to translate these properties here to properties in the original ring. Well, if A plus R is not the same as A plus 0, this means that R is not an element of the ideal A. Right? Similarly, if A plus 0, this means that S is not an element of the ideal A. Just look at, remember the property, when R are ideals the same, they would be the same if R minus 0 would lie in the ideal, and R minus 0 is just R. So I have R is not in the ideal, S is not in the ideal, okay. But what is the product of these cosets? The product, by definition of the product, is A plus R times S, right? So if A plus R times S is the same as A plus 0, this means that R times S is an element in A. So what have I found? I have found two elements, R and S, which are not in A, but their product is. So by the definition of prime ideal, I know A is not a prime ideal. Sure. Okay. So I assume I have a zero divisor in the quotient ring, right? That must be an element, and the elements are cosets. So I have this coset A plus R, which is a zero divisor. Okay, what does it mean that it is a zero divisor? It means first the element cannot be zero, because we said zero divisors are non-zero elements. Okay, secondly it means I can find another element which also is non-zero, because something times zero is always zero, right? So the definition of zero divisor is we have to have another non-zero element such that their product is zero. Okay, so this here is the definition of zero divisor just applied to the quotient ring. Just saying in the quotient ring, A plus R is a zero divisor. Okay. Now I want to translate this to properties in the ring. So if A plus 0, this means that R cannot lie in A. Why? Because if R would lie in A, R minus 0 would lie in A, and if R minus 0 lies in A, A plus R would be the same as A plus 0. The same here, S cannot lie in A. But because A plus R times A plus S is by definition of the product A plus R times S, and I said this product shall be 0, R times S minus 0 must lie in A, therefore R times S must lie in A. So what have I found? I have found two elements, R and S, in my ring, neither of which is in the ideal A, but their product is. Well, prime ideal was saying this cannot happen. Prime ideal was saying if a product is in the ideal, one of the factors already has to be in there. So A is not... Okay. The other direction goes basically in the same way. You basically can just copy it, and I leave it as an exercise for you to go through these steps. If A is not a prime ideal, you have elements R and S, so that R is not in A, S is not in A, but R times S is in A. That means that because R is not in A, A plus S is not the zero element in the quotient ring, but their product, because R times S is in there, is the zero element in the quotient ring. So you have exposed two zero divisors in the quotient ring. So the quotient ring is not an integral domain. And indeed, I could have done the argument here basically with minor modifications. I could have written it with an if and only if. I just thought it's easier to initially just write it the one way.